Tonight, what I've got for you is a story of heroes and anti-heroes. You know, we live in an age of superheroes, although anymore we can more accurately say we live in an age of superhero movies. There's always another rendition of the Marvel Universe or the Avengers or whatever else. And I look today at the movies that are out in the theaters, and you've got more of them. Gemini Man. Guess what? The Terminator's back. And to my surprise, another superhero family's back. The Addams Family. Now, as I was growing up, I remember being asked just who my favorite superhero was. And many of us were asked the same question. But I'm going to suggest for tonight that this can lead to a different version of the same question. And let's phrase it this way. Who is your hero among those in the ancient stories found in the Bible? Abraham? Sarah? Rachel? Moses? David? Ruth? Deborah? Joshua? Who is it? Let me suggest, however, that never once have I heard someone say, in answer to that question, Noah. Not even people named Noah say Noah. Here we are, though, in what is only the second parsha of the new year, last week's portion, that was read to you again tonight. And we are presented with the truly remarkable story of Noah. And such a hero he is. We know this from the very beginning because only a hero is presented with such a Herculean task. Thank you. I appreciate those of you who picked up on that. In this case, his task is build a boat to save humanity. Now let that sink in for a minute. Yeah, they're not going to get any better. But why Noah of all people? Well, we're told at the onset or at the outset, Eilat toledot Noach, pardon me, Eilat toledot Noach, Noach is tzadik tamim, haya b'dorotav et ha-Elohim, v'hit ha-leik Noach. It says, this is the account of Noah. First, he's described as ish tzadik, often translated a righteous person. Down through the generations in Jewish history, we've often labeled someone who's especially devout, someone who's especially godly as a tzaddik. Noah is the first one to get that title. And then, in case that was enough, he's called tamim, perfect or complete. That's a wow. By the way, he's the first person to be called that. In 2 weeks, somebody else is going to get called that. Jacob. And if you haven't figured out how that applies to Jacob, then you've misread the story for all these years. But that's not tonight's story. Let's stick with Noah. Now, tzaddik and tamim were further described or delineated as et ha-Elohim, hit ha-leik Noach. With God, the text says quite strikingly because of the structure, Noah walked. And then we have, as was reflected in the reading tonight, Noah did all that the Lord instructed him to do. That's more about what Tamim's all about. And by the way, remember to apply that to Jacob when we get to him in a couple weeks. And so in chapter 6, verse 18, God says, I will make a covenant with you. God's in the business of making covenants, and he makes great covenants. He probably makes great coffee, too, but I haven't asked him about that. This stands in stark contrast to what we read earlier in that same chapter where the Lord said, I will wipe out humankind whom I created from the face of the earth, humans and animals, moving creatures and birds of the air. In other words, what he's saying here is that this was nothing less than a contract to restart or to reboot creation, as the title of the Drash indicates. A contract to reboot creation. Or if you want to put it this way, creation, the sequel. A number of months ago, somebody sitting among us suggested this to me, that the flood is the world's first and largest mikveh as a sign of the world being reborn. You like that? Say thank you to Joe Cook. Very well observed and right on target. Now, as it turns out, there are two central narratives in this week's last week's parsha, but the parsha that we read for us this week. You see, this portion is rich with lessons for our day, as well as with connections to other biblical events, and it's full of historical allusions, within the greater ancient Near East, and with connections and corrections to their parallel stories, and that's a part of the story here. The most central narrative within the portion from last week is, of course, the account of the flood, of Noah and his family, and of the saving of all living creatures through the building of an ark. Now, the ark that Noah builds is called in Hebrew, Tevah. As Dr. Patrice pointed out last week, and I build on this, and something else he suggested last week, and by the way, she will complete chapter 2 or book 2 of the story, as I said earlier, next week. If you didn't get last week's version, you know where to find it. Vimeo. Anyhow, where was I? The ark. This word appears in only two places in the entire Torah. The only other time the word Tevah is used in reference, it is in reference to the reed basket that Moses was placed in by his mother. In it, he is hidden in the river to be later discovered by Pharaoh's daughter. Now, this usage was intentional, and she suggested some of this last week. The use of the word Tevah is meant to connect these two stories. So what are the connections between the two narratives? Both of these Tevahs are mysterious vessels. They are literally boxes. If you look at the dimensions of the Ark in the Torah, it's not a typical ship. It's more like a box. And both of these things are covered with pitch or tar. Both are divinely directed, meaning neither of them is guided by human means. The ark has no oars, nor any type of steering mechanism. The reed basket that Moses is placed in also is divinely directed, left to the current in the river. And both figures, Noah and Moses, now you understand why I interchanged Moses and Noah earlier. Isn't that a good excuse? I thought it sounded like a good excuse. Thank you. Both these figures, Noah and Moses, emerge from their retrospective Tevahs to become a saving figure, a rescuer of humanity. And both are recognized for their obedience and their faith to God. So the Torah wants to make clear that Noah is a saving figure similar to Moses, and God makes the covenant through both. The use of these connections also ties the whole narrative together. And I haven't even begun to touch on the connection of the biblical flood account to other flood accounts known throughout the world. Or for that matter, how the biblical account is in fact an answer, a corrective to the others. If you want to read more about that kind of thing, there are a couple really good books. I'll be happy to recommend them afterwards. The other narrative that's central to this week's Parsha, the one that we are rereading this week, again, last week's Parsha, technically, is the Tower of, not Babel, but Babel or Babel. Now, according to the Torah, a great tower was built in the plain of Shinar. If you don't know where that is, then you need to take Dr. Patrice's course next semester on historical geography of the Bible lands. That was a commercial in case it flew by too quickly. Anyhow, the tower was built in the plain of Shinar, intended to reach up into the very heavens itself. Well, God destroyed that tower and scattered the people across the earth and confused their languages because of their intentions. Shinar is believed by scholars to refer to ancient Sumer, one of the earliest great civilizations, and more broadly to Mesopotamia as a whole. Interestingly, the tower is called Babel, most likely then a reference to a Mesopotamian city with the same name, Babel. You get to know it later as Babylon. Now, according to the biblical account, the purpose for building the tower was to reach to the heavens so that the builders could make a name for themselves rather than elevating the name of God. Scholars have long connected this story with the great Mesopotamian temples that we know of as the ziggurats, which were massive step pyramid-like structures. Ziggurats were places where priests offered prayers, offerings, and sacrifices to the Mesopotamian pantheon of gods. Another interesting possible connection is that the great ziggurat in Babylon itself was called Asag Ilah, meaning the head that touches or reaches the gods. In other words, the same concept behind the biblical account. And this may well give us further insight. No, to put it this way, this gives us further insight into the reason that God destroyed the tower at Babel. So what are we to make of all of this? Well, the scriptures contain a wealth of historical allusions and references, reminding us it is a valuable source of history. But these narratives that are included in the texts are included for specific or particular reasons, and they are theological. They were meant to demonstrate to the ancient listeners, our ancestors and their neighbors, that the God of Israel was, in fact, not just the God of Israel, but he was the God of the flood account, which was known throughout the world. And the narrative of the Tower of Babel is meant then to demonstrate that the God of Israel is greater than the entire pantheon of Mesopotamian gods. And this is where we turn to the other water story and its anti-hero. Ready? Jonah and its creation echoes. So do find Jonah in your Bibles. Joel, Amos, Jonah, Micah, if you're searching for it. The story begins this way. In the first chapter, second paragraph, I'm reading verses 4 to 6. Hear the words carefully and let them sink in. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God. Hear this carefully. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. Does that sound like another storm on the sea kind of story that you may be familiar with? If you're not, think back to the Gospels. The captain went to him, verse 6, and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us, and we will not perish." That, too, sort of has reflections or echoes in those stories of the guy sailing with his disciples on that sea. By the way, I shared this story with the hermeneutics class last night, and I promised them that if they didn't get it last night, that tonight will be a good review for them. And since you weren't in class last night, shame on you. That was a commercial for signing up for classes. Anyhow, look, for the people of the ancient Near East, they understood that the gods had created order by defeating the powers of chaos, you know, like Tohu Vavohu, which we read just a couple weeks ago. The earth was empty and disordered. Anyhow, in their mythology, these powers of chaos had been merely tamed. They had not been abolished. And so they remained a constant threat. Hear me. The embodiment of these lawless and chaotic forces, the embodiment was the sea. Do you understand now why the second verse of Bereshit, as it opens, talks about the Spirit of God hovering over those very seas? In fact, the whole of the firmament. And he does so in a way that indicates he's got them under control. Not like these people understood. Anyhow, embodiment of the chaotic forces was the sea, which people could not control or tame. Therefore, frequently in the biblical text, God's control of the sea is used to stress his complete lordship over all of creation. One of our favorite Psalms, or most people's favorite Psalms, not 23, but 24. The earth is the Lord's, the fullness, and so forth. But verse 2 says, listen to this, he's founded it on the seas, he's established it or ordered it on the waters. That's our God compared to the others. Psalm 89, verse 9 says, puts it simply this way, you rule over the surging seas. Sort of sounds like what's in our text, the parsha from last week, where God says in verse 17 of chapter 6, I am going to bring floodwaters on the earth. It's under his control. Remember how our text opened in verse 4? The Lord did something definitive on the sea. It was under his control, the wind that stirred the sea. And on top of all that, Jonah, in verse 9, calls his God, are you ready for this? The God of heaven. In contrast to how the people understood their gods, there was the God of Nineveh, there was the God of war, and so forth, right on around that whole area of the world. We remind ourselves as we say the blessings, Melech HaOlam, he's king over the universe. We sing Adon Olam from time to time. He's the Lord over the Olam, which has to do with both time and space. You see, in a polytheistic society, it was difficult to find a title that would more perfectly express the supremacy of the Lord than to call him the God of heaven. Beyond that, what truly terrified the sailors in the Jonah story was the addition that the God of heaven, here's what the text says, is the one who made the sea. Now, they knew that Jonah was running away from his God, the Lord, whom they knew to be just the God of Israel. They had therefore regarded Jonah's actions as reasonable. If he was the God of Israel, Jonah took a boat away from Israel to get away from his God. They would have understood that. It made sense. It was perhaps even amusing. In order to get away from the God, you got to take a boat. Whatever. As Phoenicians, they certainly did not take seriously Jonah's claim that the Lord was superior to Baal. But now, as this unfolds, Jonah had, in the middle of a raging storm, he had claimed that the Lord was the creator of the sea. And the opening line of the verse we read in verse 4 emphasizes and reinforces that. God did something to the sea, which was under the control, to the sea. So, terrified, the sailors said, the text does not say they asked, they said, what have you done? It's an exclamation, it's not a question. Moving on to verses 11 to 16, the story continues. And as the story continues, I want you to try to picture this story as it unfolds through their eyes against the background of the way in which they viewed the world around them. So it says, the sea was getting rougher and rougher, so they asked him, what should we do to make the sea calm down for us? He says, pick me up and throw me into the sea, and it will become calm. Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder than before. They're going one way, the sea says, oh no. Then, realizing that, they cried to the Lord, not their God, but to the Lord, oh Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, oh Lord, have done as you pleased. They realized that the storm on the sea came from the one who is the sovereign over the sea. Verse 15, then they took Jonah and threw him overboard. And then listen to this from their ears or see this through their eyes. And the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. A reality had struck them like nothing else. Are you seeing this through their eyes? But that makes an important part of the story. Look, going back to verses 13 and 14. Since the sailors' religious outlook could not make any sense whatsoever of a God of heaven, a God of heaven, creating and controlling the sea. In fact, remember, they probably did not even think of the sea as created, but merely as the remnant of an original chaos. So if they see the sea as the remnant of an original chaos, to throw Jonah overboard was equivalent to murdering him. And they could not even know for certain whether they were actually doing the Lord's will. And so they feared that he might punish them for the death of his servant. So they tried hard to set him ashore, even though it involved great risk to the ship. But God stopped them. But as the story unfolds, the immediate cessation of the storm after they threw Jonah overboard showed them that the Lord really had control of the sea. And they read it correctly, and so they offered a sacrifice, the text says, to the Lord, and they made vows to him. What a story from their perspective. Are you seeing it from their, through their eyes? But wait. To this story, there's an epilogue, and what an epilogue it is. Beginning at verse 17, moving on to chapter 2, verse 1, the text says, "But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and three nights. And then from inside the fish, Jonah prayed to his God." Why didn't it simply say to God? Because the text here is emphasizing, it's clearly identifying who controlled the uncontrollable sea. The God of Israel, Jonah's God. In the ancient Near Eastern mythology, which finds numerous reflections in the Older Testament poetic language, chaos is frequently pictured by the sea monster Leviathan. And to Jonah and to those familiar with the old mythological imagery, the great fish represented Leviathan. Keep listening according to their ears. Since Leviathan itself was at God's disposal, it meant that every force in the world, however potentially dangerous, is completely under God's dominance and control. Remember, it started with a great wind that he set on the sea. At the end of the book, chapter 4, he sets up a plant to provide shade for Jonah and then causes the shade to suddenly disappear. No jokes about casting shade. All of this is to help us understand something that we acknowledged, I think it was in the Amidah, that this God, the God of Israel, is El Elyon, the Most High God. Not the best translation for that. Better would be higher than the highest. We also call him Adonai Tzivaot, the Lord of Hosts. Much better translation. Master over every force and all that there is out there. The story certainly demonstrated that. So, imagine the implications of this story now for the city of Nineveh. Now, question for you. Why did God have Jonah stay in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights? I mean, the fish could have chucked him up a lot sooner than 3 days. Oh, obviously, because Jonah was so tasty, he was getting the... No, that's not why. Foreshadowing, that's what most people would say. It is great foreshadowing, but that's not why he was there for 3 days and three nights. God was giving time for the sailors and the story from the sea to make its way across the land to Nineveh, so that by the time Jonah shows up, the story has preceded him. And they heard the story the same way I've tried to tell it to you, if you've put yourself into their sandals. And then what happens? This guy shows up. And I can imagine his demeanor was somewhat affected by those 3 days and three nights. You know, I wasn't going to go there, Sharon. All right. Okay. No wonder then all of Nineveh responded. In other words, they got wind of the story and saw Jonah's fishy appearance. So, as we conclude the related stories, let me suggest that we, like Noah, and ultimately even Jonah, need to learn to fully follow God, walking with God as Noah did, and not sailing away from Him. And then may we be bold enough, like Noah, to act on whatever God asks of us. Now look, the Lord may not ask us to build an ark. I hope He doesn't. No, actually, He promised we wouldn't have to do that. You remember last week's session. But sometimes God does ask of us tasks that often seem just as difficult in faith and action. It certainly was for Jonah. That's why he took a boat. Now, the lesson of this parsha from last week is that difficult faith is rewarded, and that the same all-powerful God is also active in the world around us today to help us through life's most difficult trials. And He will patiently persist in bringing us back to Him, even if we wander as far away as Jonah. And to help us in that journey, He's provided for us in the calendar next week's parsha, which I will read for you, from Isaiah chapter 40. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young people stumble and fall. But those who hope, confidently hope, trust in the Lord, will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Take that to heart. And hopefully, we won't end up getting upchucked by some fish. Take the next minute or so for a time of quiet reflection in the beginning of a response in quiet.